Welcome, friends, it's the Movie Boom Podcast. Enjoy the show. Zachy and Brian are talking about the movies. Movie Boom Podcast on the radio.
Welcome to Movie Film. This is episode 127, brought to you by Mr. Boy Productions. My name is Zaki Hassan, and I'm joined once again by my good friend Brian Hall.
Hey, what's going on, Zaki?
Well, it is the dog days of August. Summer movie season is over, and fall movie season hasn't quite started.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And yet, here we sit with a podcast to record.
Whatever shall we do?
Yeah, it's going to be 90 minutes of quiet contemplation. It's going to be like a Jean-Luc Godard movie. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
What have you been up to, though?
I've been keeping busy. I feel like, you know, before we gear up here for this beginning portion, I try to look back at some of the movies I've watched, and I feel like I haven't been watching a lot of movies. I've been watching more TV than I have been watching movies.
Sure.
I'm not going to talk about it for long, but I've been watching Game of Thrones, and as it stands when we record, there's only one episode left, and I feel like this season just started. So it's been an interesting season because the shows have been longer. I think the finale is even like 80-plus minutes or something like that. So it's I've enjoyed it, but yeah, it came and went in a flash, so that's kind of a bummer. Then you have to wait another year for it.
And is there just one more season?
I cannot remember how they're doing. Well, you know what? I think this is part of the part one, part two of the final season, how that's become the trend, right? It's, particularly with AMC shows. I think Mad Men and Breaking Bad did that, where they're like, the final season split up over 2 years.
Right.
I think this is the first part of that final season. But, I mean, I've seen a lot of people criticizing it for what's become sort of an accelerated pace in its timeline, and I don't think those criticisms are unfounded, but I'm still enjoying myself. And it's only ramping up in terms of scope, I feel like, with they have this battle that involves a dragon that I think is one of the most impressive pieces of entertainment I've seen all year in or out of a theater. So they're spending their money and it's showing. So I'm enjoying the ride.
Well, I'm keeping my streak alive of having not seen a single frame of footage from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny because I know a few people that don't.
And it's become kind of a douchey hipster thing now to say.
It depends how you say it.
I just like to say that I did it way before it became fashionable. Right. I was a douchey hipster way before douchey hipstering was a thing.
Yeah. I get it. It's pretty dense. I mean, there's a lot of characters. It's pretty graphic. I think a lot of people, it puts them off too. So,
I mean, for me, it's one of those things. I said it before. I said it to a friend of the show, Amelia Clark, that I'll wait till it's done.
That's right. I remember that you actually even brought that up to her.
Yeah. I love that she took that in the spirit it was intended, as opposed to being like offended by it or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think she was grateful almost.
Right.
You know, not because she looks down on the fans or anything, but I think to have something else to talk about, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny. And then, well, speaking of graphic, I guess I'll mention this. I rewatched Watchmen based upon the graphic novel.
Ah.
And it's only the only reason I watched it was because you posted your review from, what, 9 years ago? Something like that?
2009, right? So whenever that was, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. So you posted it, and I reread it just because it was there, and I enjoy reading your work.
Thank you.
And then it was on. It literally started maybe 5-10 minutes later on HBO, and it was the evening. Yeah, and I was like, well, yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it since the theater. Like, let's see. Like, I remember really enjoying the graphic novel and being a little let down by the film, and I would say that's probably where I still stand with it, watching it all these years later.
Now, was it the theatrical cut or the director's cut?
I'm relatively certain it was the theatrical cut.
Because if you have not seen the director's cut, I would highly recommend it. And it's funny because I sound like those apologists for Batman v Superman, you know?
Actually, I'm one of them.
Well, it just seems like a thing with Zack Snyder movies, I guess. But I think insofar, while BVS Extended didn't particularly move the needle for me, I think that what they cut out, the stuff they cut out of Watchmen is baffling as hell to me because it makes the movie substantially better. And I think some of the problems are still there. Like, without even discussing it with you right now, I know that some of the it feels sort of gore porn at points, you know?
Yeah. It feels more interested in those moments than it does in
the character stuff.
The characters, yeah.
You know, the performances overall are so good. The only black mark to me is the guy who plays Adrian Veidt, and I forget his name. Matthew Goode, that's his name.
Yeah.
He's like in a whole other movie. But everyone else, I think really, I think Patrick Wilson is so good in that movie.
I just like him. And he's great in the movie. It's one of those things, because when it's over, it's not that I don't like it. I do like it. I see probably the director's cut. I see like the better film that is ready to burst out of it.
Yeah.
What is there? And it sounds like then I should have, or maybe in the future I should check out the director's cut. Because yeah, it's beautiful to look at. There's some really, really wonderful moments in it. But it doesn't, for being like a nearly 3-hour movie, it chugs along. But I just don't connect with it like I'd really like to, and like I felt like I did with the comic.
One of my favorite parts of the comic is also one of the most tragic parts of the comic, and it's the scene where Hollis Mason, the original Night Owl, who we've seen throughout the story, and he's the mentor to Dan Dreiberg, right? I think that's the character's name, the new Night Owl. He's been the mentor to him, and then we see him, he gets killed.
Right.
And it's he doesn't die heroically. He's just sort of beaten to death in his house. And it's one of these moments where when you read the comic, it breaks your heart. It's staged so effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke my heart that moment didn't make it into the film, you know, and that is in fact in the theatrical, in the director's cut.
Uh-huh.
And they have Stephen McCaddy plays Hollis Mason. And the way they execute that scene is so pitch perfect.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that's one of, I would even say, like, if you recall that moment from the comic, you know, just go to YouTube and punch in, you know, Death of Night Owl or something like that in YouTube. I'm fairly certain you'll find that scene. And it's done so well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. And the actor who plays him is so good. There's a lot of great moments in that film. I mean, I truly do feel, and completely separate from the whole Zack Snyder conversation, I think that film truly did come out just too early.
Yep. I agree. It was a bit ahead of its time. I mean, it still would carry the flaws that I think people would call out for it. But yes, I think it was a little early for something, for people to go into a superhero film and it doesn't wink once.
Yeah. I mean, it's commenting on tropes that were familiar to a comic reading audience, but were not yet familiar to a film going audience. And I think in the 8 years since it came out, the sort of superhero cinematic language has become, internalized by the overwhelming majority of the people who watch these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to call it too. My favorite moment in the comic was when Dr. Manhattan goes to Mars and he's looking at the photograph of, you know, his former girlfriend, and I thought the movie captured that moment really, really well.
Yeah. I think there was a discussion, I saw some conversation about an HBO miniseries or something to that effect, and I'm kind of like, you know, it's been done. Let's move on. Let's do something else now, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't feel like it needs to happen, but I would watch it.
Yeah, I'd be interested in, but it's also like it's one of those situations where the things that Watchmen the film got right, it got so right that any new version will have to do different just to be different.
Good point. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's yeah.
But moving on, I wish I had watched more films lately. I've been a little bit busy. I actually just got back from Chicago, or the Chicagoland area, I should say, and I went on a little journey of discovery as I attended my 20-year high school reunion.
This is when the music needs to, like, fade up on the soundtrack.
I know.
Something from, like, 1996 or something. And
it was very funny because I went by myself, and while I wish I could have gone with the kids and stuff, I'm glad... In a sense, I'm glad I went by myself because it gave me the flexibility to just kind of go exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I haven't lived in Chicago for nearly 15 years at this point. I haven't. And even when my folks lived there and I would visit, it was always, I was on a schedule.
Yep.
So I didn't have the opportunity to just sort of go off the beaten path, and this time I really did have the chance to do that. And it was it was like traveling through time. You know, the phrase I've used often is that I kept seeing ghosts. You know, I was staying in Orland Park, which is where my uncle lives, and I lived there for a few months after my family moved back here from Saudi Arabia in 1992. And so there was a junior high there that I attended called Jeerling Junior High. And I was only there for 6 months, not very long, just one semester.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, I just drove by it and I kind of walked up and I looked through the, you know, everything's closed, but you look through the windows and you see the hallways and stuff. And again, you see the ghosts, you see yourself walking around there with a backpack and whatnot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and it was fascinating because you know what I kept coming back to was what would I say to myself if I could see myself, you know?
Did you?
And
figure
you know,
it out?
I think ultimately it'd be like, don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah,
right. And the funny thing is that was the same. Like I kept asking during the course of the weekend as I bumped into you know colleagues from high school and whatnot. That was what I asked them because during the course of that evening or whatnot, I went to my old high school and they let us in walking around there. Same thing. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be fine. Like that's what, you know, so it's not like and by the way, it's not like I was some tormented soul in junior high or high school. I had a fine experience. There was nothing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I would say the same for myself, but I'm certain everything seemed like a much bigger deal than it was.
Yeah, well, and that's just how it is. It's funny because when I went to Jeerling Junior High in Orland Park, my closest friend at that school is a guy named Tim Hansen. And, you know, he was actually the person who got me into Mystery Science Theater 3000. I remember him mentioning that to me. And, you know, we used to walk home. You know, along the same path, and really good friend. And I just about a year or so ago, I looked him up online just on a lark, and I happened to reconnect with him on Facebook. And in the years since, he's gone on to be a visual effects supervisor for, I mean, The Walking Dead and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Avengers Age of Ultron and, you know, Fate of the Furious, all this stuff. And it's just crazy. I mean, this is someone who I was very close to and I completely lost touch with. And then in the 25 years almost since, he's built up this amazing resume that's right in our wheelhouse, you know?
Yeah. Wow, that's so funny.
Yeah, so it's amazing the turns you take, you know? But going to my reunion, I mean, that was really the thing. Like, the thought I had, I was telling my wife this, I was like 20 years ago when I graduated, I remember thinking that, you know, when I have my reunion, I want people to know who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right, sure.
You know, and not in the sense of like, I want to be famous or whatever, but it's like, I want to show up and I want to have people recognize me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the most gratifying thing was having people coming up and be like, oh, I read your stuff all the time. Oh my God, I could read your posts all day. Oh, you're just keep doing what you're doing, you know? And that was nice, you know what I mean? The thought I had was like, you know, I think 20 years ago, Zachy would be happy.
You know? Yeah, well, good. Good. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, as long as we're talking about it, I'm sure high school reunions are very, very different for us than they were for our parents, right? Where you have this way that we're all connected through the internet and through Facebook.
That's right.
and those sorts of things. It's kind of cool that you can somewhat keep up with what other people are doing.
Yeah.
Right? And just know and that they are, you know, people read your things and you can get back in touch with people that you haven't seen in 20 years. There's something kind of cool about it. I wonder if there's Well, how does that even work? So I don't even know if this is, you want to keep talking about it, but I mean, what do you do? You're just in a big room and I mean, is it like an event or is it just a mixer or?
Well, this was like a party and it was in like a hotel hall.
Okay. So you just kind of go in and
you
mix
go
with
and
people.
You mingle and yeah, you know, and I stuck around. I didn't shut the place down. I stayed for several hours and then I left, but you
they
know,
played
I kind of made
from the era.
Yeah, it was like Dave Matthews and, you know, all that. Yeah. It got a little much after a while, you know. I also I stopped by at College of DuPage, which I feel like that's sort of a formative place for you, me and our former host Sean Coyle.
Yeah, that's where we met.
That's where well technically you and I met at the Houlihan's down the street from
COD. That's true. Well, at the
right?
Yeah.
But we took a class. That was one of those things. I went there. It was like a Saturday afternoon. It was actually I went there like before heading down to the reunion. So it was just like a time warp, you know. And I parked at one end of the school. Remember the art center
mm-hmm.
building? I parked there and I just kind of walked through the school. And it's completely different now. The interior, you wouldn't recognize it. But the weird thing, like walking through, I just saw the place I attended.
Mm-hmm.
More than all coming up on 20 years ago now. And it was funny because I had my iPhone on and I had my earphones in and I just happened to have like a John Williams playlist going. So I'm walking through the hall and then this track from Hook comes up where it's like, "You are the Pan." That's the track. And it's like when Peter Pan remembers like his moment of joy or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's triumphant. So it's this very surreal thing walking through the hall, the empty halls of COD, and then you have this very transcendent John Williams music playing, and the whole thing just, you know, obviously that was not John Williams' original intent, but I think that's the magic of his music.
The spirit behind it could be,
yeah, certainly, yeah, you know,
resonate, yeah.
But I think what it comes down to is I'm grateful to have had these experiences that I don't look back on in a negative way, that I'm glad to revisit, but I don't live in it. You know, I think there's a saying that it's great to look at the past, just don't stare. You know,
and, I don't know if I've heard that, but I like it.
You know, and I think that's the way I look at it. I'm grateful to be where I'm at. I'm grateful for the things that I've accomplished. I'm grateful for the things you've accomplished. And I'm grateful for this show, you know, because all of it is a mark of sort of, the journey we've been on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those, like I said, we met at College of DuPage and we had aspirations, and it's at the time, I'm sure we were very stressed out about them and where we would be in 10 years, and 10 years or so later, you know, I'd say we would be like, "Hey, it worked out. It's fine.
It worked out okay."
Yeah. Yeah, and it's fun to reflect back on that.
And your reunion would be next year.
Correct.
So I'm assuming we'll be having this exact conversation.
Yeah, you'll be like sobbing. It's the exact same conversation reversed.
Yours will be like you're weeping because of, you know, all of the awful horror just comes back to you. I left it behind, but
yeah.
I'm like, "It's okay, man."
And I go kind of crazy. I'm like, "But it's okay, because I built a time machine, and all I need is precious, precious electricity enough to send me back. Hold these cables, will you?"
It's funny because when you look at that era, your high school era, you know, I think society puts so much pressure on it externally. This is the period that makes or breaks you as a person. You know,
yes. The shows that you watch as a high schooler make you feel that way. Yeah,
exactly. You know, and the truth of it is, it's 4 years in and out. And you know, I don't say you shouldn't enjoy it, but it, like, don't give it too much more than it's worth. You know,
they are very formative years. Yes, but there are more years to follow. And I think, yeah, at the time you aren't.
I mean, you know, I honestly, I would say that I probably, My college years had much more of an impact in shaping who I am, in terms of making me more outgoing and more comfortable, you know, expressing myself and whatnot.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. But anywho, hey, let's talk about some movies. Sorry.
Yeah.
We took a deep dive into my psyche. This is like...
Why? You know what was this, episode 126 or something?
Like, 127. If we can't do this after 127 episodes, then well, by gum, why are we doing this at all?
Yeah, I was gonna say we've earned a little indulgence.
We've earned a little indulgence. But this is like the mailbag episode because we haven't seen really any new releases. Worth pointing out here that Logan Lucky was something that you and I both had sort of planned on catching. And I think it sort of slipped away from both of us.
Yeah, I'd hope to. And I it's one of those movies, too, where I know I will see it because I think it looks like something I would enjoy, but I'm perfectly content waiting a little while for it.
Well, I think the movie going public agreed with you, because this movie was supposed to sort of redefine the funding and distribution model, and it seems like came up a big zero.
Yeah, well, I mean, what, it opened, it was like third or something, right? Fourth? It wasn't terrible, right?
But that's not redefinition.
Well, That's true.
So eat that.
I've worked at studios where their movies have come out and they've opened in eighth.
Okay.
Or ninth. And I remember thinking, that happens? I thought everything that opened was at least 1 through 5.
No, I mean, yeah. Now. I mean, it happens pretty frequently.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think movie going in general is dropping rapidly. That's just anecdotally, and that's something that's going to end up being sort of a recurring trend. But I think that illustrates one of the problems alluded to in our first letter for today, and this is from Tyler Kloster, who says, this is his question. He says, what is the ideal number of trailers to see in a theater before the feature starts? And what number is not ideal, but at least acceptable?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he gives his background. He says, for me, I've come to realize that 3 is my ideal and 4 is at least acceptable. Beyond that, I start to get progressively more angry at each new film being advertised. Through no fault of its own, one multiplex I used to visit would run 8 or 9 trailers before the feature, and that was unbearable. Yeah, 8 or 9 seems excessive.
Hmm.
And I don't. This is an interesting one for me because most of the movies I watch are press screenings, so they don't have trailers in front of them. So when I do get to see trailers, it's kind of fun for me because I'm not, you know, there's certain movies where you see the same trailer again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see those as often.
Right.
So it's not as teeth grinding as it might be for some other people.
Yeah, I feel, so I used to live by an AMC. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, I think they used to show, say, 5, somewhere around there. So then I moved, and now I live closest to an Arclight theater, which I guess is, you could call it a, quote, premium theater. And they don't have advertisements beforehand. You're not allowed to your seat if you are 5 minutes late.
Wow.
It's like the reserve seating. And they try to make it, you know, a serious movie-going experience, I guess. And they show 3 trailers.
Okay.
Which feels brief. And 3 is nice. Like, you get to, oh, I haven't seen this, or I want to see the Star Wars trailer again, and whatever. And those work fine. But then I was visiting a friend a little further away when I saw the last Fast and Furious movie and went back to an AMC theater, which I hadn't been to in a while. And they have, you know, the whole pre-show countdown, right? Where they have...
Like Maria Menounos.
I was just going to say, Maria, yes. And they're talking about the new show that's going to be on TNT about the cocky lawyer who's also a doctor, you know. And then you,
right.
This onslaught.
Like, it's like a TNT show, usually.
Yes, yes. It's just an onslaught of things that, because it's so loud, it's not like you can sort of pay attention if you want to. Like it used to be with the trivia, you know, that used to flash up on screen.
Right.
You remember that? So it's pretty like, okay, this is happening and you're going to pay attention to it.
Yeah, we don't see those anymore.
Well, I haven't seen... Well, anyway, so go see this Fast and Furious movie at an AMC, and they have that going for, what, like 15 minutes maybe? Then they showed... It was more than 5. I mean, 6, maybe 7. And that... I think 5 for me is my threshold. 5 starts to feel like a lot. But when you go beyond that, and when it's over, you have that feeling where you've forgotten what movie you're even seeing. Have you had
that?
You know, you see, I'm like, I just watched 40 minutes of visual entertainment. Like, I'm kind of exhausted. And then you're going to go start like a 2-hour movie. So 3 I think is ideal. 5 I can tolerate. But more than that, particularly coupled with the pre-show stuff, it starts to feel exhausting.
It's, you know, back in 1998, I took a class at College of DuPage, actually, called Experiencing Movie Magic. And part of what the class was involved with was, you know, we would watch films in current release. Mm-hmm. And so we'd go to local theaters. And so one of the days they took us on a tour of the AMC in, Warrenville.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brand new. I don't think it's even an AMC anymore. But anyway, they took us on tour and they took us into the back with the screening and everything. And they said that we show 10 minutes of trailers.
Oh, so it's by time.
Yes, but that was nearly 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that has at least doubled since then.
Well, that would be 4 then, right? Because they're usually about 2.5 minutes.
The give or take, yeah.
Okay.
So,
that's interesting.
So we're at the point where it's about 8 trailers.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's by my reckoning, it's about 20 minutes of trailers. Mm-hmm. You know.
that's an episode of... television.
It's a little much, you know. Yeah. It is.
Wow.
And like I said, I don't mind it as much because it mostly, usually I'm seeing these for the first time on the big screen, you know, and I don't see them that often. Albeit, I'll tell you, man, I saw that effing Transformers 5 trailer. I don't even know how many times.
Yeah,
it reached a point where I cringed whenever I heard Anthony Hopkins' voice come up. You know?
I think for me it was Atomic Blonde. I can't even tell you how many times I've seen that trailer.
That's so funny.
It's been playing a lot and for a long time, I feel like.
Yeah, that you know, for me, I remember, like, if this is going back a ways, but like 99, Mystery Alaska.
Really?
Do you remember that movie?
I do remember that trailer even, actually, now that you bring that up.
I could not escape that trailer, and I'm convinced the movie flopped, at least partly because people were so effing fed up with that trailer.
That's such a great pull. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so that's where we're at as far as the trailers.
Yep.
Here's a question. This is from Philip Barker, who says, what is the best summer blockbuster in your own personal opinion? And I love this question because of how open-ended it is.
Yeah, I had to think about how I was going to answer that.
I feel like you can't separate the summer blockbuster from how old you were when you experienced it.
Yes.
You know, so when I think of the best summer blockbuster, I think of Batman 89 and Jurassic Park in 1993.
Jurassic Park, that's what I wrote down.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
Right? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, I mean, to me, the word blockbuster connotes not just the experience of seeing it in the theater, but it's the whole environment surrounding the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the can't wait to see it. And I think that's inextricably linked to being at that age.
Completely agree. I wrote Jurassic Park down because it's one of those films, and I've said this on here before, but when I say like my top five or my top 10, I don't think I ever list Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because it most certainly belongs there. And it's one of those things that almost has like transcended it. You know, it's become so ubiquitous in my you know, films that I love and whatnot, that I just sort of almost forget to list it. And and it's funny because that was one of the most memorable movie going experiences I've ever had. And I think a lot of it has to do, like you said, with age. I remember I was still somewhat young enough. I think I was 12-ish or 13 or something like that. And my brother was a couple years younger than me. It was still young enough to feel a little dangerous, a little scary.
Sure.
Right. And I'm sure it is still now, of course, but I remember back then, I didn't know. Was I going to see that guy get bitten in half? Like, I was actually sort of scared of what would happen next. And I also remember it was the first digital sound I ever heard in a theater. And they made a big to-do about it before the movie with this huge sort of logo.
The way the sound moves across the room and things like that.
Yeah. They do this sort of display showing off what it sounded like. And I'll never forget it. I remember what the display looked like, what it sounded like. I remember that opening scene where they're transporting the Velociraptor and just how intense that was. And it's the most times I've ever seen a movie in the theater. I saw it 8 times.
Wow.
8 times in the theater with my brother. And
that's amazing.
That's
during its initial run.
During its initial run. And then eventually when it went to second run, we were like,
but I mean,
boy.
In the decades since, you've seen it several more times.
I've seen it. Yeah. Who knows?
So 8 is just like 93, 94.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
And, I don't think that'll ever happen again, you know, that I'll feel. And again, a lot has to do with age, but just, I don't think I'll ever be that excited and enjoy a movie like I did that one.
A lot also has to do with the fact that you now wait 90 days and then you can watch it at home.
That's true. And I do remember being so excited to watch it again at home.
Right.
So yeah,
well, and because that wasn't 90 days later, that was a good 6 months easily
at least. Yeah. And I remember Suncoast Video accidentally put it out early and I bought it early.
That's probably like a night early, right? A day early.
That was probably like a day. Yeah,
but it was like you'd gotten away with something.
Yeah. So same for you, huh?
I would say, you know, I missed Batman in the theater.
I did too.
Yeah, so that's like, again, when I associate, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, when I associate that with the blockbuster, it's without having even actually had the theatrical experience. Jurassic Park, I saw it in the second run theater.
Mm-hmm.
as I recall. I saw it in the Trade Winds Theater on North Avenue in the Chicago suburbs. And that was one of those things where I had a great time, but it was like the hype had... The hype was too far along by then.
Yeah.
You know? And so even at that age, it impacted my ability to really enjoy the movie. I would say that it wasn't until the re-release a few years ago where I came to a point that I could just unabashedly adore that movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I guess I have to say 9 times I saw it on the re-release. Yeah,
right. And I think for me, honestly, a big part of why I loved it, I came around to just loving it so much, was because I saw it with my kid.
Mm.
And so I experienced it through him. And that's really, when it comes to blockbusters, that's where I'm at now, where I go with the boys because I want to share in that experience with them.
Yep.
I can't ever interface with these films in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
As I did when I was a kid, you know. I remember seeing Independence Day opening day. Actually, I'll put that on the list. That was an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because the crowd was so into it. They were applauding. I mean, it's you know, that experience elevates the film, because I'm not going to say that Independence Day is a great movie, but I had a great time watching it.
Yeah, for sure. You
know? Going from the greatest highs at the movie, this is Bushra. She asks, what are the saddest movies you two have seen? And I'm tempted here to go with something snarky like The Phantom Menace or something, but you know, but that's an interesting question. You know, I don't know, like sad in the sense of a fulfilling sad experience, like a movie that makes you sad but you're happy you saw it.
You know, I in the past say 10 years or so, I find myself getting teary-eyed more often at things.
Yeah,
whether it's TV or movies or whatnot. So I'm sure there's several, but I tried to think of what were the first things that came to my mind. The first one was very easy. I came up with 3, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'll count down. First one, so let's say number 3. I watched About Time. Have you seen that?
With Dom Hall Gleason and
Rachel McAdams?
Yes. I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
Sort of a time travel story, but wrapped around a very human story about family and love and whatnot. And I watched that with a girlfriend at the time, and there's just this moment where I was like, oh, here we go. And I just cried, like not even teary-eyed, like just cried. And I remember sort of turning my head away because I didn't want her to see me. And I just couldn't help it. I mean, the movie just did it, you know. And it's a good movie, and I recommend it, but it's definitely one that, you know, tugs on the heartstrings. 2, recently, Lion, which was sort of around for award season.
Yeah.
This past December, and I ugly cried at the end of that one. I watched it by myself. I was fortunate enough to have a screener of it, and no one was around, and I popped it in just because I had it, and I'd heard it was pretty good. And man, I got swept up in that story, and it's based on a true story, and just, it's a very bittersweet story. I mean, there are things that go well, and there are things that don't go well, and I just, oh man, it really affected me. Cried pretty hard that one. And then finally, rage cried for a film called Dear Zachary. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't even heard of it.
Dear Zachary came out in 2008, and it's, for a long time, it was available on Netflix, and I had heard people saying how good it was, so I checked it out. And a very, very brief summary is this: it's a true story. It's a documentary about this man who passed away, and he has a son. So the person who passed away, his friend, wants to make a documentary about the boy's father so the boy will know who his father was, right?
Okay.
And all I'll say is it goes from there, and it turns into one of these crazy, twisty, turny, you cannot believe this is real life sorts of stories, to the point where I remember cursing and crying and screaming at my television. And it's phenomenally done. I mean, it is an amazing work, but it is just an emotional ringer to put yourself through. So, Dear Zachary.
There, and that's number 1 for you.
Yeah, I'd say. I can't remember any other movie where that has affected me the way that movie did.
Man, I'm trying to think. I can't remember the last time I cried at like a recent film. I mean, I think I said this. I rolled a tear at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but I almost feel embarrassed saying that after your list.
No. Oh man, all I did. I tear up so much.
If I'm honest, yeah, I absolutely rolled a tear at the end of that because that affected the crap out of me. I don't know, man. You know, I can't think of like a straight up sad movie that I've seen recently. I mean, other than like Schindler's List, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And that's one of those, it's funny because I was just yesterday I was talking to my wife about, I was like, oh, have you seen, because we own it. It's almost like you should own Schindler's List, you know?
right.
You know what I mean? And so I was like, oh, have you seen Schindler's List? She's like, I've never seen it. I was like, oh, you should watch it. And then she's like, yeah, but when am I going to watch it? Like, because you really have to be in a particular headspace to watch it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a movie everyone should watch without a question.
But yeah, I haven't seen it since the 90s, but I don't. I am interested to revisit it because I don't remember a lot of it. But when are you ever in the, you know, I don't know. It's.
Yeah, it's you have to plan around it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like, okay, all right, I'm about to do this. You know, it's not like, hey, let's put on Schindler's List, get the popcorn going and let's watch, you know, the Holocaust.
Yeah, I know. So
I saw it the one time. I saw it in the theater back in, I believe, early 94. And then, I mean, and it stays with you. Like, it is, I certainly didn't leave it in the theater, but it's, I haven't felt the need to revisit it because it still feels as the imagery is sort of burned into my cranium.
Oh, yeah. There's certain moments, I mean, yeah, that just won't go
away. The little girl, you know, the coat.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's me. So sorry, Bushra, you don't get an answer from me. here's one. This is from Edward Sanders. It says, pros and cons and tips on sneaking food into theaters.
Chili pockets. 2 Ziploc bags in each pocket. Chili. Chili pockets.
Chili. Like, take a spoon. It seems like that would end badly. I don't know. Is sneaking food into the theater still like a scandalous thing? I just assumed that people do it.
It seems, I think some theaters don't even seem to mind because you'll go to some places and there'll be someone behind you with a to-go box of, you know, what, like a big burrito or something, where instantly the whole place smells like burrito, right?
Sure.
So I don't know. I do remember a couple years ago, I bought a big cup of coffee. And I was really excited because I was going to see a movie at 10 a.m., got a cup of coffee. I was like, let's do this. And they made me throw it away. The moment I came in, I had to dump it in the garbage. I was so mad.
That's some, like, airport-level security shit.
Yeah, that was obnoxious. So it's weird. It seems like different places have different takes or rules on that. But I don't know that. Do you sneak food in? I don't really sneak food in that much.
My tip is just eat before you go.
Yeah, I don't. Well, I think it's easier if you have a purse. For starters,
sure.
Right? And so, I mean, all we tend to have are our pockets or like a coat.
No, I carry a purse. It's European.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It's European.
Man, I'm trying to think of the last thing I ever did sneak in.
See, I mean, as a general rule, I don't like buying theater concessions because it's obscenely expensive and it's ridiculous. So you get popcorn and soda and there's like $15 right there.
Yeah.
Right, and you can't just get the popcorn because your mouth will be bone dry inside of, because it's like the half the per capita of salt, you know, of a small country is doused on your popcorn, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I give it a lot of thought, and then the other thing for me, honestly, is if I go to the theater with kids, then you can't just buy one person popcorn. Right.
Yeah. I mean,
and here's actually, sorry. Here's the bullshit thing. Because you'll be like large popcorn, and they'll be like, you know, for a dollar more, you get this bucket that you can free refill. You can swim around in like Scrooge McDuck, you know, and so they fleece you because that's some bullshit right there, right? Because how much popcorn are you really going to eat?
Right. I think those sizes were devised by scientists. So you want just a little more, or it's too much.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
I'll never forget my friend Anna and I. We went to this movie, and they convinced us to buy the huge tub, right? Because they had free refills. So what we did is we took one of those cardboard boxes that unfolds, and we dumped it into that. And then I went and refilled it, And we ate a whole bucket, and then we started eating the equivalent of a second bucket.
Okay.
Because it was there, and we were watching a movie, and you're not thinking, you're just forcing it into your mouth. And I remember we walked out of there sick. Just
I would imagine. I'm getting sick hearing you say that.
Yeah, and we were like, man was not meant to eat that much popcorn. So I haven't... yeah, I like the medium size these days. Actually, I do, but with what you said, I do actually buy concessions. I've become a popcorn guy, and okay. I didn't used to be, but in the past couple of years, I'm a popcorn and Coke guy.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, for me, you know, because the kids are always like, oh, can we get popcorn, whatever? And I'm like, how much do I owe these kids? I'm taking their ass to the theater. I'm already spending like $70 buying the tickets. I'm like, yeah. And usually we go in the morning. I'm like, sit your ass down at the table, eat some cereal.
Yeah, eat an Eggo. And
let's hit the road, you know? Can we have popcorn? Kids these days.
I should say, just for the anecdote, as long as we're talking about it, I remember when they re-released the Star Wars Special Editions back in 97.
Yeah.
And Return of the Jedi came out, which we've talked about it on our commentaries. That was like my favorite growing up. And my brother and I think we already saw it in the theater for the re-release. But then we're like, you know, after school, let's just go. Let's watch it again. As long as we can see on the big screen, let's go. So what we did was, and I mean, movies cost, what, $4 at the time or something like that? Mm-hmm. So we put on coats. And I remember we put like Chips Ahoy cookie bags in our coats. We loaded up. And then we went in the theater and we were the only ones in there. And I have this memory of watching Return of the Jedi, which we well could have watched at home on our television. But we had the theater to ourselves, our feet up on the chairs, and we were just eating our pantry in that theater. So I haven't done anything quite that level since.
This is the Rice Lake Theater, you said?
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. And that's still around. It's not called that anymore, but it exists.
Yeah.
So that's our, yeah. Sorry, I don't know if those constitute good tips, but
yeah.
Sure. Here we go. This is from Jeff Jordan.
Yeah.
And he says, I wanted to applaud you on your recent commentary track for Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. See, I told you, Brian, you were like, nobody's going to want to hear this. And I said, no. No, Brian.
Yeah, well, I have to wash your car.
There you go. So fly over.
That bet.
That didn't pay off for you. He says, while I didn't vehemently hate that film like many typically do, it didn't blow my mind the way I was hoping. Join the club, Jeff. That it would when it came out in 2001. But there was one point of contention I had in this film that I don't think you or Brian touched upon, and that was in trying to understand what the ape actors were saying half the time.
Oh, interesting.
Long before Tom Hardy's vocal inflections as Bane... There were Tim Burton's ape actors. Indeed, there were points in that film where I felt the actors were struggling to speak through all their prosthetic makeup and teeth. You'd have thought they would have had the presence of mind to have the actors return to record pickup dialogue in post-production. That's kind of true, I guess.
Yeah. You know what? Not to switch gears, but a movie that drives me crazy and I almost can't watch for multiple reasons, but for that specifically is The Grinch. Ron Howard's
Grinch. Yeah.
It drives me nuts watching Jim Carrey try to talk with those fake teeth.
That's another Rick Baker joint, by the way.
Yeah, but he has this, like, he tries to make it a part of what he's doing, but it clearly just sounds like an actor who's trying to speak through fake teeth, and it just, for some reason, really gets under my skin.
I gotta say, I'm glad that the brief moment where we were trying to do live action versions of the Dr. Seuss catalog like quickly faded away, you know?
Yeah.
That was just ill-conceived all around, you know?
Yeah, taking a 16-page book and turning it into a 90-minute movie is just...
An agonizing 90-minute movie, by the way, because I watched The Grinch... And I was like, well, it can't get any worse than that. And then the Cat in the Hat kicked me in the balls like 2 years later.
The Cat in the Hat kicks back.
Yeah. You know, but yeah, that's kind of true. I haven't seen the Burton movie enough to make that observation, but I guess that's true. I mean, when we watched it for the commentary, it was with the sound off.
Yeah. And I seem to recall Giamatti having that sort of phenomenon like Jim Carrey did, where he's doing good work. I mean, he is emoting through that makeup, but he has a kind of thing going on.
That, Paul? Giamatti?
Yeah.
Are you on the show with us? That's really funny. It's funny because the Tom Hardy Bane thing, it's kind of a bum rap. I got to be honest. I don't have a hard time understanding him in that film.
I don't either, but I do remember the first trailer where he was nigh impossible to understand.
It wasn't even the trailer. It was like the IMAX thing.
Yes.
Thing that they showed, right?
Yeah.
I love the Tom Hardy Bane voice because it's so emulable, you know?
My brother and I talk about this all the time. He hates it. And I'm like, okay. I can't explain it. I really like it. I don't know. There's something about it.
Come on.
Do it.
So you've returned to your city. Like, it sounds like Tom Hardy's kind of making fun of the movie.
Yeah, you're right. Everything.
Yeah. It's like I've come to get you. Oh, you've come to get me. Like, that's it.
Yeah. What's your next plan?
Crashing this what's plane. Your next plan? Like, the whole movie is just him making fun of Batman. Yeah. Everything he says.
I love it.
Anywho.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff, for that. Yeah, I don't disagree. And that's the reason why I'm glad that we no longer have prosthetic makeup. No, I'm
just... I was like, really? Wow.
Because of that, no. But I mean, obviously, that's certainly something that Andy Serkis and company did not have to deal with on Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and that trilogy.
Yeah, which is interesting, by the way. Slight tangent, because it reminds me of a story I read today where they were asking, I can't remember if it was Scorsese or De Niro, but it was one or the other, and saying, what do you think about this next movie you're doing going straight to Netflix? And they're saying, well, hey, look, there's going to be a lot of de-aging effects going on the characters, because I guess it takes place over a series of years.
This is what, like The Irishman or something? What is it called?
Yeah, I believe that's what it's called. And they were saying Netflix was willing to pony up for the effects.
No kidding.
So they're like, yeah, we're going to be able to make the movie we wanted at the level we want, which is, I guess, estimated at about $150 million, because Netflix will pay it.
Holy moly.
So,
that's crazy.
A, that's interesting. And that's kind of cool in a way, because then I guess otherwise this movie wouldn't exist. So it's kind of nice that it will exist. But also, it's interesting. And what I got out of that story was, are we past physical makeup? I mean, are you just going to apply appliances with computer software now?
It's funny because in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, you know, the opening scene has a de-aged Kurt Russell, right? Uh-huh. And it was funny because in all of the interviews, Kurt Russell's like, you know, that wasn't effects. That was actually my makeup guy, and he knows me real well, and he knows how to light me, and blah, blah, blah. And, like, the CGI people are like, yeah, no, it's CGI. They're like, stop saying that, Kurt. Like, you're doing a disservice to the work we do, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny because you watch the scene, you're like, that's not makeup. Okay, now granted, God has been kind to Kurt Russell.
Yeah,
let's stipulate that.
Yeah,
but come on, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, instead, it used to be you would hire, say, in 89 Batman, for example, first thing that comes to mind, when they had the young Jack Nicholson character played by another actor who resembled him, right? And he's got the eyebrows and the eyes and the nose and whatnot. But now, would they just take Jack Nicholson and de-age his face instead of, you know, I don't
right.
know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
So.
That's a thing.
That's a thing.
Another comment. This is from Rob Kelly, host of the Fire and Water podcast, which, by the way, you and I recently guested on.
Yep, and are big fans of.
Big fans of the show. And I think I've said this before. I don't listen to our show, usually. Once we record it, it's just out there in the ether. Mm-hmm. But this one I listened to right away because it was a new phenomenon to be on another show with you.
Yeah, right.
It was very interesting. But I had a really good time participating in the discussion, but I had just as much of a good time listening to the discussion as we talked about the 1970s MASH feature film. So I hope everyone who's listening to this show you should be subscribing to Fire and Water, mm-hmm. The Film and Water podcast, excuse me. And check out the latest episode. It's the MASH one. It's part of the Fire and Water Network, but it's the Film and Water podcast. But this is in reference to our Raiders of the Lost Ark commentary, which just dropped last week. Wow, and I'm hearing people enjoyed that, which is kind of nice.
It's been really gratifying, yeah.
Yeah, a couple people being like, you know, the best episodes you do are the commentaries, which I don't know how to take that, to be honest. It's like, and then Matty Feck, one of our listeners, he actually purchased the Indiana Jones movies on Blu-ray just because he was moved to do so by our Raiders commentary track.
You're welcome, Spielberg.
Yeah. So if only we could use this power to funnel money into our pockets.
Yeah, right. But I hope he enjoyed it. I hope it was a worthwhile purchase then. I mean, I'm sure it was, but...
Well, as I responded to him on Twitter with a GIF of the knight from Last Crusade saying, "You have chosen wisely." thank you, Giphy, for always being there for us. But this is Rob's comment. He says, "Really enjoyed the Raiders commentary. I was glad Brian hit on something that I think is woefully under-recognized when it comes to Raiders. The screenplay. That sucker is airtight. In terms of construction, dialogue, mood, everything. As great as the movie is in its casting, pace, look, music, the screenplay is pretty much flawless. Think about it. Is there even a single scene in this movie that anyone says is kind of dull? But you sit through it to get to the good stuff." That's true, actually. Mm-hmm. "The scene in the college library with the army guys should be boring, yet I could watch those guys get schooled by Indy and Marcus all day. One final note regarding Marion. It's been established that Indy was Lucas's attempt to do a Bond movie, something Spielberg was keen to do, and the original idea was to mimic the Bond formula and give Indy his own Bond girl every time. But they and Karen Allen did their jobs too well. Marion is such a wonderful original creation that I remember being a kid seeing Temple of Doom for the first time, and once I learned Marion was nowhere to be found, I was really disappointed. And as bad as Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is, I'm glad it exists, if only to bring Indy and Marion back together."
Yeah, it's, I mean, we mentioned this, but we've both seen Raiders so many times, and I'm sure I had the thought before, but it was one of those things that stood out to me on the last viewing, just how well constructed that script is. It doesn't even have to be. I mean, it's better for it, and that's why it is the classic that it is, but I mean, now you could have some movie where you're like, it's kind of silly, but it's fun. It had this really great thing where this car jumps from one building to the other, but you know, you don't remember much else. But yeah, Raiders, every scene feels essential. Every scene has a moment that you like about it. The dialogue crackles, the characters have depth. It's a really, really great script.
Yeah, I think that the testament to any film's ability to be exceptional is how many decades into the future you're watching it. And, you know, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark works the same way Casablanca works, or the same way the original Star Wars works, mm-hmm. or, you know, Citizen Kane, etc. I mean, The Godfather, you know, I mean, The Godfather is a 3-hour long movie and same kind of thing. I mean, every single scene is worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
And you just know it. You know it in hindsight, obviously. I don't think they know at the time that they've just, you know, the bat has hit the ball in just the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we talked in our Return of the Jedi commentary about how there's like this pothole in the middle that you do sort of have to get past.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can't say that about Raiders.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't know that I would say that about any of the original three Indiana Jones movies, even Temple of Doom, which is thought of by a few. As being the weakest of those three.
Yeah, I really look forward to doing a commentary with you on that one.
We should do that, Brian.
Yeah, we should.
We should do a commentary of Temple of Doom, since we've already said we're going to do it. So, seems like that we should follow through.
Yeah.
That's a comment. Thank you, Rob, for that. Thank you. And thanks for having us on. I hope you will have us back. And this is from David Oler, who says, "I've come to crave a new episode to hear you guys talk about movie news and hear your reviews. Just got caught up on the past 10 or so episodes. Mm. You're officially in my regular podcast routine." Hey, nice.
Yeah, wow.
So don't screw this up, Brian. Don't say anything like randomly racist or anti-Semitic, as you tend to do whenever we have a good thing going. We appreciate that, obviously. The greatest thing about doing this show is it's just us talking. We enjoy talking to each other. And the fact that there's so many people listening, way more people than we know, listening to us just doing what we do anyway, that's kind of cool. You know,
I can't even tell you how much it means. It's really nice. And when people, one of my favorite comments that I hear is when people say they talk back to us.
Yeah.
Because that's what we hope. We hope this sounds like a conversation between friends. And if you listen, you're a friend. You're a friend of the show. And so it's cool having so many people enjoy being a part of the conversation. So thank you for that.
This is true.
That note.
Yeah. And with that in mind, take a listen to these advertisements. Well, we're back, and Brian, we got some headlines to discuss. It's been a little while, and some of the stuff has built up.
Yeah, I'm looking at our list here, and I guess there are a few things I didn't realize we hadn't even talked about, so.
Well, top headline, and this is from a couple weeks ago, but James Cameron is out there talking up the Terminator 2 3D re-release that's going to be in theaters just a few days after we record this. You planning on seeing that?
Oh, yeah.
I think I mentioned before, I'm going with my oldest, and my wife just found out that I'm going with my oldest, so this she wasn't on board with the idea, let's just say.
I was going to say, and how did that go?
Well, it's the negotiation, we're horse trading right now.
Wait, how old is he? Is he 11?
He will be 11 in January.
Okay, I mean, obviously that's, you know, different kids develop differently. I saw the movie when it came out. On video, yeah, immediately on video. So
you were like 11.
11, 12, somewhere around there. And
yeah, I mean, honestly, my 8-year-old really wants to go, and I'm like, no, sorry.
Yeah.
I feel like...
Well, you
I
know
feel
who
like,
he's going to be rooting for.
Yeah. Right.
If you listen to the show.
You know what's funny is we're just talking about Indiana Jones, and we were watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, and so my oldest is like, oh, you know, I love the third one, that's my favorite, and I'm like, oh, why? And he's like, oh, you know, I really like the relationship with the dad and whatnot, you know, that's my oldest. And then my second, he's like, I love the number two, and I'm kind of like, why do you like that one, you know? And he's like, and I know what he's gonna say.
Yes.
I know what he's like, I just, you know, the part where they make him drink the blood from the sky. I'm like, of course, that's the part you like.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like there needs to be a comic strip about the two of you.
So I am legit terrified of this kid.
You, the Force Awakens story, probably one of my favorite stories of all time. But, yeah,
and then so. There was Rogue One. Let's not forget.
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, I was like, oh, which part did you like? Oh, the part with Darth Vader. And I'm like, oh, why do you like it? He's like, I just like it when the bad guys kill the good guys.
Yeah.
So that's this kid. But regardless. So,
Terminator
so
2, yep.
Terminator 2. So that is coming out. So, of course, James Cameron is out there talking it up. And I got to tell you, there's nothing I love more than James Cameron interviews, because he does he has no shits to give, James Cameron.
Yeah.
Right? He's achieved the level of success in Hollywood where he's like, look, what are you going to do, fire me? I'm going to say what's on my mind. And so he's opened up about all kinds of stuff. And he's talked about Alien Covenant, which I thought was really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
So he was, I got to say, I think James Cameron is on our side of this argument.
Oh, of Alien.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Because what I said about Alien, I said it's a beautiful, terrible movie.
Yeah. And it's hard not to, I mean, we can allude that we were saying the original Alien movies that we like have these sort of aspirations that the characters are leading toward. And it felt like this movie did not have that. And it was interesting to see that James Cameron had the exact same feelings, where he's like, it's a beautiful movie, but I tend to like to make movies with aspirations toward the end.
Yeah, it's basically like, I try to make movies that don't suck. That's basically what he said. let me read his exact quote, just so that he doesn't see us for misquoting. So he says, I thought that Alien Covenant was a great ride. It was beautiful. I love Ridley's films, and I love his filmmaking. I love the beauty of the photography. I love the visceral sense that you're there, that you're present. It's not a film that I would have made. I don't like films where you invest in a character and they get destroyed at the end. I would not have made that film. I can't comment on where Ridley is going with it, but I think he's obviously trying to create a greater universe around it and more backstory with the engineers and so on. I'll show up for the next one, absolutely. That's basically our...
That's
you
too
and
long
I...
didn't read for our review, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because same thing. It's beautiful, it's garbage, but I'll watch the next one.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the too long didn't read.
Yeah.
And it's entirely consistent because he said the exact same thing about Alien 3, which I compared Alien Covenant 2. It felt very Alien 3-ish.
Mm.
But he also talks about the new Terminator movie that he's due to reclaim the rights, like in a matter of months or something, right?
I officially do not understand how copyright law works.
Yeah.
But whatever. It's great.
The term is X number of years plus whatever, and since he created the first Terminator in 1984, somehow the rights to the franchise are due to revert to him.
Interesting. Okay, that's great.
So now, of course, it's now that it's coming back to him, it's, well, is what's he going to do with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what James Cameron has to say about doing a new Terminator trilogy. He said, the question is, has the franchise run its course or can it be freshened up? So I'm in discussions with David Ellison, who's the current rights holder globally for the Terminator franchise, and the rights in the U.S. market revert to me under U.S. copyright law in a year and a half. Okay, so in a matter of months. So he and I are talking about what we can do. Right now, we're leaning toward doing a 3-film arc and reinventing it. Now, here's where I'm at with the Terminator franchise. Even the idea of James Cameron doing something with it is not enough to get me excited.
It's the only thing that can even produce a spark of optimism in me, I will say. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like they've done it so many times, and they've done it with different directors, and they've all felt different, and none of them have worked. Right.
It's just funny to me that the last three Terminator movies were all meant to be the first part of a trilogy. So we have a trilogy of Terminator movies that is each supposed to be the start of a different trilogy.
Yeah. Well,
something.
It's hard because I actually was trying to think about this. And why do the first two work so well? And there's this thrilling/terrifying pursuit, like our hero is being pursued, right? And that's an element of both films. But how many times can you do that and still have it be thrilling? And I was like, and a lot of people have said, well, I'd love to see a version of it that takes place in the future with the war. And I get that, but we've had so much commentary and pontification on the wars from other films that it almost feels like they're inevitable. How would they really end? Like, there's no, like, Death Star, like, ultimate sort of stake to them, right? Like, they're just sort of this thing that happens, and according to 3, right, they're always going to happen. Like, they can't be prevented, so that doesn't feel
it's
very exciting.
It's inevitable.
Yeah, you know? And then also, the T-800 with Arnold, he's been reinterpreted so many times that I'm kind of tired of that character, in a way. Like, I don't...
Right.
Having him reinvented in the second one as a hero, which Arnold, all the way up to shooting, thought was a bad idea, but Cameron so believed in it.
Wow.
I mean, it's one of our favorite films of all time, but what else can you really do with him? And they've tried, and they've had him do jokes, and they've had him, you know, and it's just, none of it really feels, it's like, you know, it just, I don't know. I don't know what they could do to make it feel fresh and vital again.
Well, in case you're wondering if now we're at the point where we're going to get a Terminator movie without Schwarzenegger, that's still not on the docket because he's actually come up, or he's probably brainstorming a way to work Arnold in, right? And I don't know if you saw this quote. Essentially, he was asked by the Arnold fan if he thought about having Arnold play a human character. And this is his response. He said, yeah, you got to ask yourself, why did they make these characters look and sound like Arnold? There has to be a reason. So yeah, it has flashed through my mind that there has to have been a prototype. There has to have been a guy whose DNA was harvested from, that they grew the organic outer layer that they grew the Terminator from, and that presumably was a real person at some point. Now the question is, did that person have some sort of meaning to Skynet on why they chose that one? Or was it like a whole rack of Terminators and the one that happened to be the Arnold model just happened to be closest to the door going out to the time displacement center and all the others look different? I've asked myself these questions, but it's never been resolved, so stay tuned. We're talking pretty seriously now about doing some new Terminator films or possibly a trilogy, and you'll just have to see what surfaces in those.
I mean,
I will say this. I will say this before you say anything. I love reading James Cameron, like his brainstorming.
How so?
I mean, it's just, this is his thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if anyone has the right to just kind of go in there and really get into the weeds about all this stuff, it's the guy who created it.
Yeah.
And that's awesome, you know, because what we've gotten, I'm like talking against myself from just a few minutes ago, what we've gotten since, essentially since 1991, is other people's interpretation of the universe James Cameron created.
Right.
So if we can go back into that universe, I would imagine it can't help but feel more authentic than anything we've gotten since.
That's the hope, and that's why that little spark of optimism is not put out yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
wait, before we move on, I mean, yeah. Didn't Terminator 3 have a deleted scene that alluded to that, by the way?
Yeah, it was the Sergeant Candy scene.
Yeah. Where?
And that's... And thank goodness that was deleted.
Well, I mean... you know what? Now that I say it, I bet the majority of people haven't seen it, except for people like us and the people who listen to the show.
Right. Yeah. Go online. I'm sure you can see it. So it's a scene it does that. It explains why all the Terminators look like Arnold. And it's Sergeant Candy, who's like the spokesman for the Cyberdyne company. He's Arnold. He's played by Arnold, but he's got like this kind of boss hog voice.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's the guy's name? The Boss Hog's deputy. What was his name?
I don't remember. I never really watched that show.
Roscoe Picoultrain, you know? James Best.
There. Yeah.
There's something I don't remember because I know that.
Yeah.
But so he's like, this is the weapons that we're making. Now, this is Arnold, bear in mind. He's like, this is great, and look at this. And the people who are watching are like, you know, this is great, but can we do something about the voice? And then the doctor, who's like this skinny wiener looking guy, he's like, we can fix it. And that's Arnold's voice.
Yeah.
And then they put you can see that. It's a good thing. People dislike the third Terminator. I am not one of them, but I am glad that they cut that out, because that movie was like skating on the border of self-parody as it is.
Yeah.
But hey, we have some DC movie news.
Yeah.
Bunch of stuff going on with Justice League. Now, I don't know if you saw this. Like, Joss Whedon has been the subject of this, like, I don't know if we would even call it a scandal.
Yeah, I didn't even know if we would talk about it or not.
Well, it's worth mentioning. I mean, so Joss Whedon is, of course, directing the Justice League movie. And in the past couple of days, his ex-wife wrote this op-ed where she really... threw him under the bus for presenting himself as a feminist and whatnot while having also engaged in affairs and whatnot. And just to be very clear, don't care about that. Certainly I'm not judging him or her or whatever the ins and outs of that. But I do wonder if this is something where Warner Brothers is like, oh, geez. Is this like a fire we need to put out now?
I thought the same thing. I'm sure they thought, hey, cool, we got... this guy helping us out over here, and then that breaks.
Steady Eddie, you know? Like, yeah. He's going to guide the ship to a gentle landing, and then oops. So the latest rumor here is that Lex Luthor, who was supposed to have a role in some capacity in Justice League, has been dropped. He's on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. Kind of interesting. I mean... and this is all rumors, right? I mean, probably someone who has inside knowledge sharing with someone else and whatnot. But
well, this comes from Batman on Film, which I think is, as far as these things go, is about as authoritative a site as there is in so far as DC news goes.
Uh-huh.
And somebody asked one of their reporters, how big will Jesse Eisenberg's role be? And the response was, he doesn't have one. If he did prior to all the changes / reshoots, it was cut.
Hmm.
So there's no like, well, maybe. It's like, nope, he's not in it.
Interesting. Well, I mean, we left him off behind bars, right, in some sort of high-tech prison, and he could come back for a Superman film. I mean, Justice League feels like it's already got a lot of characters to contend with, so.
It seems what I'm hearing is that Justice League, which was intended to be much more open-ended, they're doing less of that.
That's good.
Not because they're expecting it to fail necessarily, but I think they're doing less of like the sequel setup.
Yep.
So what I had read was that initially it was supposed to end with some kind of a setup for Darkseid showing up, and the villain in the piece is Steppenwolf, who's a character who is one of Darkseid's minions essentially, and he's played in the film by that guy, you know.
You know, what's his name?
What is that actor's name? I've gotten really terrible at remembering actor's name. It's really...
Actually, I'm sorry. I don't know off the top of my head.
Kyron Hines.
Oh. Who's that?
He's... Oh, dude, you've seen him. What would you have seen him in? You've seen him. Like, for sure, I know you've seen him. Mm-hmm. He's in Some of All Fears. He's the Russian president. Have you seen Some of All Fears?
It's a long time.
Let me see something recent that you would have seen him in. Justice League. Oh, wait. I'm, like, looking at his IMDb. Yeah, I don't know. You've seen it. Anyway.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Anyway, so but the film as it exists now apparently is much more like closed-ended. Like, okay, he's the villain, and we're going to defeat him, and that's it.
That's been one of the biggest criticisms of a lot of these cinematic universes, right? Where they just spend too much time setting up other things when we want to enjoy the thing we're watching right now.
Yeah, let's just make this a fulfilling experience without worrying about what's coming down the curb.
Yeah.
With that in mind, a couple bits of pieces about the DC cinematic universe. This is interesting. There apparently there's a Joker origin movie that's in development with Todd Phillips and Martin Scorsese involved. I'll be honest, like Mad Libs. I was just about to say, I read that headline. I was like, oh, it's a Mad Libs headline.
Name a random director, and you look at The Hangover on your bookshelf. Yeah, Todd Phillips. Name another director. You know, you look over, see a Goodfellas poster.
I don't know. I read this, and I'm like, even the names involved, even Scorsese being involved, doesn't make me particularly interested. This will have apparently nothing to do with the Joker from Suicide Squad, who apparently it's just being decided that we're just never going to refer to that again.
I know. And their excuse, right, is this is going to be set in the early 80s. So it'll be played by someone else. Anyway, playing a younger version of the Joker. But how old would that make him then in these modern films?
Yeah, if it's set in the early 80s, I mean, geez. Like, Jack Nicholson's Joker was in 89.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. So, I feel the same way. It's funny because, man, like 15 years ago or something like that, if you told me there was going to be a Joker movie, I'd be like, It's so funny. I mean, it's a product or a symptom of a lot of things, obviously. I mean, we are accustomed to superhero movies, so they don't feel special anymore. And we've been burned so many times by certain things that we can sort of see the bad version of this first.
Yes.
And also, I don't... Joker feels like a nice spice in the stew.
Yeah.
But a whole movie about him just feels
that
like it could be...
That sounds excruciating to me.
Yeah, and punishing.
Yeah.
Right? He's such a dark, unrelenting character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Batman's foil is the Joker.
Yeah.
And you use the Joker as texture for a Batman story and put him in a story that gives us a greater insight into Batman. I think if we're at the point where a villain like the Joker of all people becomes the protagonist of the story, we've lost the thread. And I say that specifically about the Joker because I can see a Lex Luthor movie I would be interested in watching. Not the Jesse Eisenberg version, but I can see doing like the rags to riches story of this guy who ends up selling his soul. Like, that's something interesting potentially.
Yeah.
Right? I can see a Magneto movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you tell me we're gonna put Michael Fassbender in a movie all about Magneto, I might be interested in that. Mm-hmm. You know, the Joker, though, the Joker is not a character. You know, would you want to watch a movie all about Heath Ledger's Joker?
Well,
without Batman in it?
I don't, yeah. I don't know. I have my reservations about it. I do remember several years ago, there was a fan film about the Joker. And I'm actually trying to Google it right now, and I cannot remember what it was called. And it was about him as a henchman and his sort of, you know, slow rise to becoming the Joker. And it was not bad for a fan film. It was pretty good, actually. So I almost wonder if they need to buy up the rights to that one because it sounds like the movie they want to make.
I mean, I think that if you are going to do a Joker origin. You use maybe the origin portion of the Killing Joke,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if you've read that.
Yeah,
that could be something interesting where he's a somewhat sympathetic character, and then this tragic loss happens. I think that if you're using, I mean, I don't know, you know, I mean, we've gotten a Batman. We've gotten a Joker origin in Batman 89.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know. Does the Joker need an origin? You know, I think Dark Knight proved you don't. He doesn't.
Who knows? Who knows? I know. Yeah, I have my reservations, but curious. I mean, Todd Phillips is an interesting director. You know,
he
makes these movies, and I don't always love all his movies, but he does feel different.
Sure.
You know, he feels like he's got a little more of a voice than a lot of comedy directors out there. So I'm curious what that's all about. And Martin Scorsese, I think, helps sell an image in your head, or at least a tone in your head.
Yes.
That said, I didn't really like Vinyl very much, which was the last thing he produced for HBO,
yeah,
right?
For HBO, right.
So, you know, I don't know. I could see it mattering.
Well, I mean,
not mattering much.
While we're talking about Batman, I mean, I guess a good connection here is the latest word of The Batman, which is the Matt Reeves-directed Batman solo movie,
yep.
which apparently, per latest quotes, will not be connected to the larger DC expanded universe, and it's meant as a standalone movie. Now, this quote is being taken to mean it's not part of the DC cinematic universe, but I don't know. I see some wiggle room there where my take on it was you're not going to be like, oh, and there's Doomsday over there and there's the Justice League. Like, it's a Batman story. It exists in the universe, but it's not, you know.
I completely agree with you. Like you said, people are running with that whole other notion that this is completely unrelated. And then when I read the quote, I was thinking that's not at all what he said.
This is the problem with clickbait.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the quote from Matt Reeves, and again, this is via Batman on Film. Well, I have a vision for a way to do something with that character that feels like it resonates with me personally in a perspective that can grow out into other things. When they approached me, what they said was, look, it's a standalone. It's not part of the extended universe. And I think that's, it's not meant to set up any balls that are going to be paid off later.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, Ben Affleck is very vehement that he is for sure going to do this movie. And I think the more vehement he gets, the more sure I am he's not going to do it.
You are firmly planted in that camp. And I don't know. We'll see.
I'll eat crow. Hey, I've done it on the show before. I have admitted my error. But at this point, every time, I mean, you can plot like a causal chart. Every time he's like, I'm for sure doing this, he for sure doesn't.
It was funny, though. Casey Affleck, right? He was on some sort of show, and yeah. He's like, yeah, my brother's not doing that, and they're like, what? Because if that's true, yeah. This is breaking news. He's like, I'm just right. kidding.
It's kind of like at the beginning of the interview when Eminem just says he's gay,
right? Yeah, yeah,
But yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm not interested in a Joker movie. I am interested in what Matt Reeves has to do with Batman.
Very interested. Yeah, I'm excited about when he says he has a vision. I'm like, whoa, well, what is it?
Share your vision, yeah. Please. Let's take a little break, and then we'll talk some Star Wars news on the flip side.
And we're back, and Brian, we got some Star Wars news.
Yeah. Yeah, some big Star Wars news, actually, right?
And with that in mind, let's cue the music. There it is. What do we got?
Well, we have the announcement of yet another Star Wars movie.
Well, and I gotta say, you know, I've the one spinoff movie I've been waiting for pretty much since they announced the spinoff factory, the assembly line. I was like, this is the one that I desperately, desperately want.
I'm the talking Salacious about, Crumb.
Dude, I swear to you, that's what I was about to say.
What?
I swear to God.
I'm so sorry for stepping on your toes.
I was like working up to that.
Unbelievable.
I was like and then you said it.
I'm sorry for taking the joke from you.
That's amazing. Out of all the characters,
That is weird.
That is bizarre.
Yeah.
That's extremely bizarre. We're not, of course, actually excited about the Salacious Crumb movie. Although I would probably watch it, I gotta be honest.
I would, of course, I'd see it.
It would just be 90 minutes of... but what are we talking about, Brian?
We're talking about the Obi-Wan Kenobi spinoff film.
Oh, snap.
Snap. We, like you said, I think we saw this coming.
Yes.
I wish, you know, I haven't spoken to the man myself about it. Have you?
As a matter of fact, Brian, unlike you, I've actually hung out with Mr. Kenobi.
That's
or Obi,
that's true.
As I call him. Yeah, you know, we played my conversation with Ewan McGregor on this show last fall. He was promoting American Pastoral, his directorial debut, and I got to ask him a little bit about that. And the cool thing is that certainly as far as Ewan McGregor is concerned, he still has a lot of affection for having played this role. It's not something he's bitter about, although that is kind of the narrative, you know?
With him?
I mean, in the media, like, oh, he's sick of Star Wars fans and stuff like that.
Oh, huh. Well, I mean, yeah, I certainly don't get that impression from him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he loves the role and he loves how, you know, kids have grown up with it. If I was him and I was dealing with Star Wars fans constantly, I would probably be fed up with them too.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Shoving action figures under his nose to sign and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure it's taxing. But he did participate in The Force Awakens. He came in especially to record a hushed
one line,
couple words for that one. So
these are your first steps.
Yep. Yep. So, well, I like you said, this is one that we are both totally on board for. We love Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan Kenobi, and it's just the only question really is at what point in the timeline is this going to take place, right?
Yeah, I think the assumption is that this will slot in somewhere in between episode 3 and episode 4, but I don't know. I mean, there's room to do a Clone Wars story, I suppose, if they wanted to. Something in between episodes 1 and 2. Something in between episodes 2 and 3. I mean, there's you know, Ewan McGregor has aged pretty well, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would think they could figure something out.
Well, and you wonder if it's after dropping Luke off on Tatooine, I mean, is he sort of chained to that planet, the things that he can get involved in? Because it's, you think he's there to sort of watch over him, right? Or, you know, there was a Marvel Comics, like, one-off issue about that very thing. And I'm sure that sort of idea could be stretched out into something exciting. So, I don't know.
I've said before, I really like the idea of, you know, somebody comes and seeks him out. Like, it's like True Grit. Or Unforgiven, you know, William Money, you know, like the aged gunfighter who's called in for one last battle.
That would be pretty awesome.
You know, and I think we've said before, you know, the whispers of the possibility that Rey in the current series is somehow connected to Obi-Wan, and we sort of blew that off. I don't discount that entirely because, I mean, what we've heard a lot of is that they've held off on any kind of Obi-Wan story because of stuff going on in the current films.
Mm-hmm. Which, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think the fact that Rey's vision, the last thing she hears is Obi-Wan Kenobi's voice... Would you be shocked if some kind of connection between those two emerged? You know?
No, I would likely enjoy it.
Yeah, right, you know? So with that, let's say hypothetically she's like Obi-Wan Kenobi's granddaughter. If this film is sort of him meeting her mother or something like that, I could see that happening.
Yeah.
The Jedi Order is no more. Who's to say he's bound to the vows or whatnot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Possibility.
I mean, yeah, it's a huge shift for him to go from that. I mean, he was fairly obedient with all those things, right?
Yeah.
So for him to go out that and be this gunfighter with no... Yeah.
So this is in the works. It's very, very preliminary. Stephen Daldry is attached.
Mm-hmm.
Who... Didn't he do, like, Billy Elliot?
Yeah, Billy Elliot, The Hours.
The Hours.
The Reader. Right. He did Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Kind of an unorthodox choice for a movie like this. I wonder if Lucasfilm went to him or if he went to Lucasfilm.
I don't know. Well, he also did The Crown, I guess, or at least he produced it. I don't know if he.
Okay.
I'm looking right now. Yeah, he directed a couple episodes. Oh, he's,
as of now, Ewan McGregor isn't even attached.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a...
It feels like a formality. I mean, God, do you do this movie without Ewan McGregor?
I could not even imagine.
That's the appeal. The appeal is whatever the hell it's about, we get to see Ewan McGregor play Obi-Wan Kenobi again.
I agree, and I feel bad that Lucas is going to have to hear that finally Ewan McGregor's going to be in a good movie playing Obi-Wan Kenobi, but let's be honest, it's kind of what we're thinking.
He deserves a film that lives up to his universally beloved performance as Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yes.
Like, I don't know of anybody who dislikes the prequels who dislikes what he did as that character.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think he's just, he's a liked person, liked actor, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, if you haven't heard my brief conversation with him, do check that out. I don't remember what episode it is, but it was from last fall, and he was great. He was fantastic, and it was just a cool, one of those geek out moments for me. You know, I get to do a lot of fun interviews. This is one of the ones where I'm like, dude, I just met Ewan McGregor. You know,
yeah,
you know. But what else do we got going on, Brian?
All right. Well, it seems. Like, doesn't it seem like we're hearing more about this Han Solo movie that's coming out next year than we are about The Last Jedi, which is coming out this year?
It feels like it. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, because of the you know, the shenanigans that happened behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think, well, yes, exactly that. And I think people, it makes people fascinated now that there's going to be some version of this movie that we'll never see. And along with that is Michael K. Williams, who was going to be in this movie. He of The Wire and The Night Of, and I think he was in Community for a while.
I love Michael Kenneth Williams. He's so great.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. And he had a role in the Phil Lord Christopher Miller version of the Han Solo movie.
Yeah, that's right. So he's the first casualty other than Phil Lord and Christopher Miller.
Yeah, but isn't that interesting? I mean, that really shows you that this isn't just being sort of molded a little bit, massaged. I mean, this is being revised.
Yeah.
So anyway, this was his quote to Deadline about being cut from the film. When Ron Howard got hired to finish out the film, there were some reshoot issues that needed to be done in regards to my character in order for it to match the new direction, which the producers wanted Ron to carry the film in. And that would have required me on a plane a month ago to London to Pinewood to do reshoots. But I'm here on location in Africa. He says, it's scheduling. I'm not going to be back on the market until end of November after the series he's doing, Happen Leonard. And for them to wait that long for me, that would have pushed back the release date, which I believe is May 2018. They wanted me now. I couldn't go. So they had to clip, clip, clip.
He seems to be in good spirits about it, at least.
So that's, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it seems like this reshoot time was baked in already. On the other hand, maybe it just went longer than they expected, and it was something he couldn't accommodate. But that's a big deal, right? To cut, I mean, out of a Star Wars film, which you think they could move heaven and earth if they wanted to get the movie that they want to put out, to cut an entire character for this reason.
I'm wondering if they're just going to recast the character.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah.
You know, and then what I found sort of amusing is that Michael K. Williams takes great care in the interview to say, but I had a great time and they're great over there at Lucasfilm. Yep. So I think he's kind of like, he knows how his bread is buttered. You know?
I thought the exact same thing. I was like, yeah, you definitely want to leave. Like, so next go around.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. But he said that he did play a half human, half animal character who was a kick ass character, in my opinion. And I'm proud of it.
There you go.
It's too bad.
Well, and I loved the Donald Glover's recollection of meeting Billy Dee Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you see this? So it was funny because I think we talked about this like a little while ago where Billy Dee Williams sort of gave his take on this meeting from his side. And it's like, yeah, I had lunch with him and he was a lovely fellow. Like it was like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, of course, Donald Glover is playing the young Lando Calrissian. So he gets cast. What does he do? He makes plans to meet with Billy Dee Williams. I would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Had I been cast as Lando. It was between me and Donald. I'm a little disappointed. But I love this quote. Did you see this?
Yeah.
So this is Donald Glover on meeting Billy Dee Williams. I was like, I've always felt like this character could do this, and he represents this, and I kind of feel like he comes from here, and it's very obvious he has a lot of taste, so maybe he grew up seeing that from afar. Maybe I'm like that. Maybe he saw it from other planets and was like, I want to be that. He just let me ramble on, and then finally I was like, so what do you think? And he goes, yeah, I don't know about all that. Just be charming. I love that. This is like the modern equivalent of Dustin Hoffman meeting Laurence Olivier. Have you heard this story?
Yes.
They were filming Marathon Man, and Dustin Hoffman's character is like been on the run for a few days. He hasn't gotten any sleep. So he's like, for the past few days, I've been sleeping on park benches and I haven't eaten and all this. He's trying to impress Laurence Olivier, and Olivier is just like, well, have you tried acting? You know?
Yeah.
I love the humility in Donald Glover, mm-hmm. in telling this story. You know, it's a cute story.
It's funny though, all the things he was mentioning. I mean, I don't know that I've given Lando that much thought, and
yeah,
I mean, I like him as a character and what he's present, the way he's presented. But thinking of him like that, it's like, oh yeah, that's cool. That's cool. He's thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that. I don't know, man. I'm even with all the shuffling behind the scenes, I'm excited for this movie.
Oh, me too.
I don't see Han Solo as an inviolable character that can't exist outside of Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I see that. Whenever an article comes up, there's always someone in the message board saying it's terrible and they won't go. And I don't know. I'm looking forward to it.
And we still don't have the title for it, as far as I know, right? I mean, I would think you should just call it Han Solo, A Star Wars Story, and
Why
be done
not?
With
yeah.
it. But there's no official title.
No, not yet.
Now, you were mentioning The Last Jedi. There is some new stuff about The Last Jedi that came out a couple days ago where Rian Johnson, speaking of Han Solo, was talking about Han Solo's impact on this. Have you seen this, right?
No, I don't know if I have.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So Rian Johnson was talking about the role that Han Solo plays in this film, and in essence, his ghost, metaphorical ghost, is going to hang heavy over the storyline because, of course, Kylo Ren's rise to villainy happened after stabbing Han Solo and killing him, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is what Rian Johnson says in reference to Kylo Ren. He says he's definitely been knocked off base. The defeat that he had at the end of The Force Awakens, but even bigger than that, his huge defining act, which, spoiler alert, is the murder of his father. That's the more interesting thing to dive into. How has he dealt with that in his head? Where is he at in terms of that act, and what does that mean for him? And he then goes on to talk about how, you know, the death of Han Solo is just as much a driving factor for Rey, right? Because he was the father that she never had.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is Daisy Ridley. She just doesn't understand Kylo. When all she wanted was parents, why would a person who has parents do that? It's so beyond comprehension. It's ridiculous. So she has grief for the loss, and then there's anger. To be honest, she couldn't understand doing something like that, let alone to your parents. And this is Rian Johnson. He says, Han, the ghost of, well, not literally. I don't want to misguide. I have to be very careful with my words here. But a figurative ghost of Han had to be present throughout this entire film. I got to be honest. All that stuff has made me more excited for The Last Jedi than all the other stuff we've seen. And I have been excited for The Last Jedi.
I completely agree. I had not heard any of this. And everything you were saying was like, oh, this movie sounds like it's in real good hands.
It sounds very Empire Strikes Back-ish, you know, like getting really under the skin of these characters. I love the idea of Han Solo being the source of enmity between Rey and Kylo Ren. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
only a couple months to go.
I know, man. I'm psyched. I was actually on my plane ride back from Chicago. I popped on The Force Awakens, and I haven't seen it the whole way through in a long time. I gotta say, man, I like it. It's a good movie, you know.
I actually just recently watched it with the J.J. Abrams commentary.
Oh, nice.
And I really enjoyed it. He had a lot of interesting things to say, very thoughtful things. You know, you really appreciate that he's the guy that got to do it because, I don't know. Yeah, it just seemed very thoughtful. And it was also, just for people who are interested in filmmaking, and in particular a movie on this big a scale, just hearing how much they were figuring out along the way. I'm always fascinated by that. Like, Like, even now, even though I know that it's not true, I still feel like you get a really great script and then you shoot a movie. Like, you just kind of have that sort of notion. Right. But it's like, no, I mean, you just think so much while you're making it and revise and revise and reshoots. And
the process never stops.
Yeah, and he kept pointing out. He was like, oh, this is on the roof of Bad Robot. This is on the roof of Bad Robot. Like, just things that they would pick up and then throw in.
By the way, this is Rian Johnson in reference to Chewbacca. You want to hear this?
Yeah.
So obviously, how's Chewie doing right after Han Solo dies? Chewie without Han, that seems, you know, there's something just inherently sad about that. But here's what Rian Johnson says. He says, Chewie's doing all right. It's tough. It was obviously a big loss for him, but, you know, he's Chewie. He's resilient. He's got broad Wookiee shoulders, and he also has a new mission. He's got Rey, and she's someone that Han, to a certain extent, handed the keys to. So I think that that helps. If Chewie was just unemployed and sitting at home, things might be a little rougher, but he's got a task to focus on. So that's cool, man.
Yeah, yeah. He's, by the way, he and Ron Howard are both fun to follow on Instagram, because every now and then they'll throw out these little teaser images, and they're pretty fun.
You know, I said before, of all the people they could have hired, I don't think they could have picked someone better than Ron Howard to do the Han Solo movie, because how can you dislike Ron Howard? He's so lovable. Even when you dislike a movie made by Ron Howard, you still gotta like Ron Howard.
I know. Yeah.
So, brilliant bit of a PR puffery there.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I sit here, my phone just sent me an alert from the Hollywood Reporter. The Joker and Harley Quinn, Joker and Harley Quinn to get their own spinoff movie.
Seriously?
So we covered that. Of course.
Is this separate from the other?
Well, remember, because she was going to get her own spinoff. Now the Joker's getting his own spinoff, and now it sounds like them as a duo are going to get their own spinoff.
All right, this is my message to Kevin Sugihara at Warner Brothers, Diane Nelson at Warner Brothers. You guys own DC Comics. You own DC Comics. DC Comics is this amazing universe of characters that has a bench that goes far out into the distance. Batman is a fraction of that. Put Batman to the side. There's a comic series from the 80s called Who's Who. And it's all about all the characters in the DC universe. Buy back issues of that. You can get them in a quarter bin at your local comic book shop. Call them up. Call up your local comic book shop. Say you're the head of Warner Brothers. They'll send it to you for free. And just look through all those pages and find literally any non-Batman character and make a movie out of it. And just make it good.
Find their Guardians.
Yeah. Try it.
Let's see if a Flash movie works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
You know what, though? I get it, because if you go into a Hot Topic, what's 50% of their store? You know, Harley Quinn, Joker. So, yeah. I get it.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm not saying, you know, I'm...
I mean, look, I'm all about seeing more Margot Robbie in anything. Or out of anything. I'm not picky. Right. More Margot Robbie, I'm down. Yeah. But come on, let's pretend that you have a deep bench here, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good place to leave this episode, Brian.
Yeah.
We will be back soon with the new commentary track, and we'll be back on the other side of Labor Day with our annual post-summer movie wrap-up. And we'll look at the flops and the hits. I think there might be more flops than hits this year. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in there. Looking forward to sort of looking back on it. And
mixed in, like little bits of bacon in our mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
But we'll be talking about that in our next episode. Until then, Brian, is there anything you want to hype up for our audience?
Yeah, I'm currently writing for a show called Puppy Dog Pals, which you can find on Disney and Disney Junior. And if you have young kids or you love puppy dogs, I think you'll dig it. So check it out, Puppy Dog Pals.
There you go. And as for me, you can find me online. My website is zakiscorner.com. That's Z-A-K-I-S corner. That's also my Twitter handle, minus the .com. That's also my Instagram handle. And you can find our show at moviefilmpodcast.com. You can also find us at iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please go to iTunes, leave a review, leave a star rating, let people know what you think of the show, let people know what you dig. And every little bit helps. Also, if you have any feedback for us, you can hit like on our Facebook page, facebook.com/moviefilmpodcast. You can also email us at moviefilmpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for all the feedback we've gotten. Thanks for the overwhelming mailbag we got for this episode. Please keep those coming. We're going to enjoy, I think, doing mailbag episodes every once in a while, so it's fun to just riff, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun. And it's a good place to wrap up this week, but we'll be back soon. So thanks again for listening. This has been Movie Film 127. We'll be back soon.
Welcome, friends. It's the Movie Film Podcast. Podcast, enjoy the show. Zachy and Brian are talking about movies. Movie Film Podcast on the radio.